Welcome, welcome to the Mushroom Revival Podcast. This is your host, Alex Dorr. We love to dive in to the wonderful, wacky, strange, mysterious, incredible world of mushrooms and fungi. We bring on guests from all around the planet to geek out with us and go on this mystical fungal voyage with us. So if you don't know, this is the Mushroom Revival Podcast. If you want to support the show, we don't have a Patreon or anything like that, but we do have a website, mushroomrevival.com. If you want to check out a whole line of functional mushroom extracts, etc., we also have a giveaway going on where you can win some goodies. Link is in the bio. But what you're here for is our amazing guests. This week, we are bringing on Hamilton Pevic with a new feature short film about some magical, wonderful mushrooms. So, Hamilton, how you doing?
I'm very well. Thanks for having me, Alex.
Yeah, so I just watched this film last night, and it was incredible, and I loved it. And I didn't know much about Psilocybe azarescens before this film, and I went down like a rabbit hole last night, and they're really cool. I'm glad you covered it. So, who are you? What inspired you to start this film? What got you into mushrooms? Tell the listeners, who is Hamilton Pevic?
Hamilton Pevic, me. I'm a career filmmaker and mushroom geek. I've been making films for 22 years, and I've been hunting mushrooms since 2009. And I had a pretty integrative experience with mushroom hunting from my very first mushroom hunt, as I'm sure you can relate to, and many of your listeners can relate to, that when you get exposed to mycology, whether it's through wild mushroom ID or cultivation or another avenue, it can be overwhelming and it can be really, really inspiring. And that's what happened to me on my first mushroom hunt, is I went with someone who had a lot of experience, and he was able to, you know, he knew all the Latin names, which of course is impressive when you first get into it. And he could explain what the Latin meant, and he could talk about the relationships that the mushrooms have, and, you know, whether or not they're food and whether or not they're functional and all that kind of thing. And so that really kicked me off onto my mycology journey. And it's been a long, winding road since then. I spent a better part, well, I'm still doing taxonomy. I learn new mushrooms every year, doing wild identification. I try and add new edible mushrooms to my repertoire every season. I love experimenting with rare mushrooms and eating them. And the thing about hunting mushrooms in Colorado is that we have a super short mushroom season, you know, 6 weeks if we're lucky, which really isn't very long. It's not long enough by any standard. And so I got into cultivating, you know, to extend my mushroom season more or less, and spent many years cultivating standard gourmet mushrooms inside and outside. And I spent a stint in the Himalaya, about 7 years in the Himalaya in Nepal as a mushroom farmer, organic mushroom farmer. And during that time is when the door opened for me regarding functional mushrooms. And when I started hearing about that, like, they were on my radar, but I wasn't really paying attention to them in the, mid 20 teens. And once I started learning about the functionality and active compound, I really got deep into that and went down that road. And that's kind of where I'm at now in terms of, you know, what my interest in mycology is, even though that's expanded into applied mycology and particularly ethnomycology. But I had an experience at the beginning of the pandemic when I had to escape Nepal I got on one of the last planes before they closed the borders. And I went immediately into quarantine in a trailer in my town where I had 2 weeks alone. And I unearthed an old film project that I had shot 7 years before about hunting Ophiocordyceps sinensis in Nepal with my brother-in-law. And then I made a film about that called Suklal's Hunt. And as I was making this film in quarantine, and like, it was basically a passion project, everything clicked really, really well. And it kind of came together perfectly. And I had a kind of revelation, a kind of download, you would say, or maybe it was a message, you know, some direct transmission from the fungi, I don't know. But I realized that all I really wanted to do was make movies about mushrooms, because it was combining my passions as a filmmaker and as a mushroom geek. And so I released the film at the very first Fungi Film Festival, and it was well received, and it was fun, and it sort of opened this door. And I realized that, like, how am I going to pay for films about mushrooms? You know, nobody's going to pay for movies about mushrooms. Like, who's going to do that? So it occurred to me that I could finance these films by selling functional mushroom extracts. And so I started Hamilton's Mushrooms, and that's what I do. I sell functional mushroom extracts in order to finance mycology-centered film and finance mycology events and education, and hopefully ultimately to finance actual science and research. And so my latest film, Azure Essence Through a Blue Lens, is just one of these many projects that is now being paid for by functional mushroom extract sales.
So when did you start the film? What is it about? For anyone who hasn't seen it, can you give kind of a trailer, an audio trailer of the film?
what's the classic trailer opener? In a world.
In
where mushrooms rule the planet. So Azure Essence Through a Blue Lens is part of a documentary series that I'm doing. The first episode was Suklal's Hunt about Ophiocordyceps sinensis. And now this episode is about Psilocybe Azure Essence. And what the series explores in each episode is it focuses on a single mushroom and then looks at the relationships that surround that mushroom, from the people who are hunting it or cultivating it, to the people who are, or rather the relationship that the mushroom has with the environment, its role that it plays in the environment, its role that it plays in economics and society. And we look at sort of the impacts and the relationships that surround that particular genus or species. And so the film follows my brother Lucien and his friend Fred on the hunt for Azies, traveling up the Pacific Northwest coast on a kind of pilgrimage, because in the mycology scene, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, it's kind of this legendary mushroom to go hunt. And, I started hearing about it, and it was kind of, it had that sort of mythological quality where it was like, oh my God, you're going to hunt this very rare and precious potent mushroom that exists only in this tiny geographic area. And, oh, if you eat it, you might get paralyzed. So it had all this, lore surrounding it. And the opportunity to go on the hunt happened in November 2021. And I hopped on it right away. I normally travel out to Northern California to hunt mushrooms every year. And so it corresponded perfectly with that timing, and I would not have missed it for the world. And so, yeah, we traveled up the coast. We spent 5 days filming, and then that made up the principal photography, which was the initial mushroom hunt. And then, I started researching the mushroom after that principal photography and looking at its role as a psychedelic in society and economics. And the thing that really spiked my interest was learning about the ecology of the mushroom as a primary decomposer and how and why that matters so much, particularly where it goes. So the film really dives into its ecological role and its ecological backstory as a kind of equalizer in the ecosystem. And as I started digging into it and researching a combination of rumors and mythology, I started uncovering what was really going on with the mushroom and the culture that surrounds it. And the film explores that in particular. I don't know how much.
It was ahead. A very interesting beginning because, you know, I've heard all the rumors of like, it's such a rare mushroom that only natively grows in one specific valley region, and only the people that are in the know where it grows. And now, of course, there are patches that people have artificially cultivated in other regions of the country and even the world. But, you know, where you were shooting, that was like where it first popped up. And you gave a really cool kind of history in the film of why it first popped up. And I'm just curious if you can give a little one-on-one on, you know, you said they're kind of like there in response for ecological reasons, you know?
Right.
So why did they pop up in the first place?
And this is still a theory.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of, you know, physical evidence to support this. So the European settlers arrived, quite a long time ago in the 1800s, not earlier, in the West Coast. And when they arrived into this specific region of northern Oregon and southern Washington, they built a jetty at the mouth of the Columbia River. And this jetty, it's to control the tide so that boats can come in and out of the river, the mouth of the river, and to calm the waters. And one of the side effects of this jetty was that it caused a massive buildup of sand inland. And they called this rampaging dunes, where the sand started pushing inward and burying farms and pasture land and disrupting the forests and like really causing problems for the settlers that were living on the coast at that time. And so in classic human fashion, they were looking for solutions to manage these rampaging dunes. And so they imported a strain of European beach grass called Ammophila arenaria, I think. It did a very good job of catching the windblown sand and creating four dunes on the beach, basically helping to save all this pasture land and prevent these rampaging dunes and unbury these farms. And, so it worked. And the thing that they didn't understand, they also introduced, Scotch broom. And these are both now considered some of the most invasive species on the Pacific Northwest coast. And they are traveling all up and down the coast, hundreds of miles that they've traveled now 100 years later. And it causing
it's
significant
so funny
problems
how,
to the ecosystem.
How many times this happens, you know, throughout history of humans cause something like an entire eradication of a species, and then they try to solve it, and they always introduce something worse.
it happens
all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not very good at understanding, you know, the greater, you know, systems
the long,
of things.
The long view on messing with ecologies, you know?
Yeah.
And like Ecology 101 says, don't move species around, like leave them in place. Like everybody I talk to, all the ecologists, all the dune specialists, all the experts that I spoke to said, you know, this is like classic no-no.
Yeah.
And we've learned over the you know, last 150 years,
some of us,
not more, that, yeah, well, yeah, we can point to it and say, oh, yeah, look what happened in Australia, you know, with the cane toads or
right,
whatever, you know. And yeah, now it's happening on the Pacific Northwest coast with these two species of plant, the European beach grass and the Scotch broom. And so to take that one step further, you know, so now they're invasive. They've, you know, which is a loaded word anyway, you know, for the listeners out there that understand sort of the nuances of what an introduced species is versus an invasive species. There's a lot of debate around that as well.
Yeah.
So I'm just using that to describe what's happening, but I don't necessarily land on one or the other side of that debate of how to talk about introduced species. So the mushroom is described and started, it's starting to be found in the mid 70s. And it's found particularly on rotting wood and growing alongside the beach grass and the Scotch broom. And as a primary decomposer, we understand that it's actually decomposing these grasses and Scotch broom plants. And now we understand that after about 40 years or so, due to the decomposition rate, this European beach grass can form a very rich layer of topsoil. And so you can imagine that this mushroom is growing in response to this sort of monoculture of grass that has disrupted ecosystems and disrupted these a few different animal habitats. And it's presenting itself as a possible solution to equalize these coastal dune ecosystems and to sort of regain balance ecologically, where this is one of these delicate ecosystems where, you know, it any kind of disruption is massively impacted. And then we can introduce the human element again into this story, which is, you know, if this mushroom is acting as a decomposer and helping to manage these invasive species, then it raises the question and brings up the conversation around, can we use this mushroom to mitigate the beach grass all along the Pacific Northwest coast? And that's what I really wanted to bring up in this film, was to start the conversation about spreading the species around. And that's a whole other conversation. And a loaded one too, because it brings us back to this
right,
you know, ecology 101, which is like, don't spread species around. However, if it's managing these other species that are causing all these other problems, then shouldn't we consider it as a possible short-term/long-term solution?
And it wouldn't be the worst thing to have all over the place.
Right. Who's going to complain about extra magic mushrooms growing in appropriate areas?
Oh, what a drag. Yeah. Just such a bummer. I mean, oh, the worst. And there's actually a group doing that, right? Called Wood Lovers United, that you interviewed. I think the founder of Wood Lovers United, which
That's
is
correct.
A group of people actually doing this, of taking, you know, cultures of Psilocybe azarescens and, you know, bulking it up on wood and then convening in secret places and on, you know, on secret dates and spreading the spores, so to speak, and making kind of guerrilla garden patches all over the country to kind of fight against this over harvesting of these mushrooms. Because, you know, you talked about it a little bit in the film, it's this Michael Pollan effect of people, you know, getting into Michael Pollan for the first time, realizing that Psilocybe was, you know, incredible, figuring out where azarescens grows, then creating a stampede of people and over harvesting this mushroom. And so Wood Lovers United was kind of fighting against that over harvesting and allowing the biosecurity of this species.
Correct. Yeah, there's kind of a two-prong human impact that's happening, particularly in this very small geographic region where the mushroom exists. And so it was, you know, a heavily guarded secret by locals. As you know, mushroom hunters can be very protective of their spots, particularly of honey holes, and very territorial. And so when Woodlovers United is a Facebook group with about 11,000 members that focuses on wood-loving strains of psilocybe mushrooms and other psychoactive mushrooms, they kind of helped blow up the spot. And in response to that, well, they felt the attitude was that they felt partially responsible for blowing up the spot. But the second prong of that exposure was Michael Pollan's book, where he goes with Paul Stamets to go hunt this mushroom and then tries to be clever about hiding the location, but inadvertently, I don't know, gives it away.
Yeah.
And the difference between these two audiences are enormous. You know, like the few thousand people that are in the group versus and the number of locals that know where it is versus Michael Pollan's audience of millions. You can imagine that it created a mass rush to this area now for a couple months every year. That whole zone is booked out. There's lots of people out there hunting. And this causes significant human impact, you know, especially if the people aren't the foragers there aren't doing like sort of sustainable best practices for foraging. And there's a number of things you can do to protect the species. You don't have to, you know, ravage the area and in order to take home your supply. So there's certain things you can do, like having mesh baskets while you carry your fruits around and spread spores. You can also take the stem butts off the bottom of your mushroom and replant them so that you're establishing mycelium in new places. And, you know, pack it in, pack it out, leave no trace. And that's just not the situation. There's a lot of disrespectful foragers that mess up the area. So there was this impetus to protect the zone and to, make amends with having exposed it.
Yeah.
And the Woodlovers United group meets secretly to a couple of times a year to spread the spores. They do liquid culture, they run it out on wood chips. I tried to get in on this. I asked if I could join the group for the hunt. And the Mike Ozak, the creator of the group, went to the group members who were participating in this activity and said, you know, is it okay for Hamilton to join and record our spawn spreading party? And they, I don't know exactly, you know, how the vote went down or not, but the response that I got back was, you can come, but you're not allowed to film.
Right.
And I thought, well, I'm not going to, you know, drive 2,000 miles to California and if I can't film the event. So I asked him to take pictures for me and use some of those in the film. But yeah, I mean, there's still a lot of people that want to protect their identity, that don't want to expose this kind of subculture of this very niche community.
Makes sense.
And I respect that. And you know, that's totally
still
fine.
A schedule
course,
one. So, you know, like makes sense.
Right. And that raises the question. Go ahead.
No, it just, you know, some of you might be wondering, if you have no idea what this mushroom is, like, what is all the hype about it? Right. You know, it is fairly easy most places to get, you know, quote unquote, regular magic mushroom, Psilocybe cubensis. They're grown so easily. It's probably one of, if not the easiest mushrooms to grow, you know, at home. And so what is all this hype about this rare mushroom, you know, growing in this specific region? You know, why are people going after it? Well, it's toted the most potent magic mushroom in the world. And it has a very interesting array of compounds. So, you know, it has double the amount of psilocybin, but it has about two thirds the psilocin, which psilocybin in your body, I don't know the exact chemical term, but it breaks down maybe into psilocin. I don't know if breaks down is the right
converts
into psilocin. Yeah. And psilocin is actually the active compound that, you know, makes you quote unquote trip. But it also
crosses the blood-brain barrier.
Right. But psilocybe azarescens has up to 14 times of this one specific compound called baocystin, which we don't have much research on, but, you know, is one of the main tryptamines in magic mushrooms that is getting a lot of hype recently, because we're finding out, you know, all these different mushrooms have all these different compounds beyond psilocybin and psilocin, and what do they do? So I know you brought on someone on the film. Doma is his name, right?
Yeah, Doma Nunzio from Magic Mycofam.
He seemed to know quite a bit about baocystin. Did he have anything to say about it? You know, I'm just curious if you know, if you talk to anyone of like why we think it has so much of this one particular compound.
Right. Well, the conventional wisdom around these active alkaloids now is that they exist within the fruit bodies as a kind of antibacterial, antiparasitic, antibiotic, a survival compound to protect itself from, you know, other organisms in the ecosystem. But I think that's just like sort of a functional role that doesn't tell the whole story, because we have the locks that these active alkaloid keys can plug right into in our brain. So there's this larger understanding of the role of these alkaloids in the world, because we have the receptors in order to take them in, and they can have profound impacts on our lives and our psychology, our mental health, our physiology. So they're not, I don't believe that they're just acting as antibiotic within the ecosystem. They perform a much larger role in our lives.
Effect on you?
The bottom line is that, yeah, they do. It's
wild,
dude.
Wait, what do they do to you?
Well, first they make me,
because it's just an antibiotic for me. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I mean, just anti-inflammatory and help me relax and focus, you know. And then, you know, I ski better and I hike better and I find more mushrooms and I, you know, get better ideas and I play better and I feel more free and all kinds of good benefits.
So someone described microdosing while hiking as enhanced hiking, and I will never forget that. I think it's great.
the old psych and hike.
Psych and hike, yeah. Love it.
Yeah,
love
no,
it.
I mean it. Yeah, it's amazing how effectively and consistently it helps you feel connected. You know, in this very mycelial kind of way, where you go hiking on a micro and you feel the air better and you smell the forest terpenes more and you have your sixth sense is, you know, heightened and everything connects and you feel everything more. You feel much more part of nature. And that's one of the measurable functional aspects of this medicine. or lack thereof. Excuse me.
of philosophy. Yeah. Yeah.
Of philosophy. So, yes. Thank you. Thank you.
And Doma, you slipped this into the film, which blew my mind, and I tried to Google it after and I couldn't find anything on it. So I'm hoping that you could kind of elaborate a little bit more, but you brought Doma on. He had some words to share about Psilocybe as a Essence, but then you said, hey, Doma's mm-hmm. pretty famous in the scene. He won the first psilocybin cup for having the most potent strain, and later on, you know, was pretty fundamental for people developing like very potent strains of psilocybe. And he came up with this technique called the antibiotic fusion technique. And you kind of slipped that into the film. And so I'm curious, what is the antibiotic fusion technique?
Right.
Yeah. What is it all about?
Yeah, this is fascinating. You know, let me preface this by saying that like a 30-minute film about a single magic mushroom is really just a snapshot. Like, you need an entire documentary series to talk in depth and comprehensively about psychedelic mushrooms. So yes, I could only touch on a few of these things. And one of them is this antibiotic fusion technique, which he was telling me is, and I don't understand the chemistry of it because I'm not that heady of a grower, but it allows the mycelium to become soft and malleable enough that two different strains of mycelium, or rather two different species of the same strain, can fuse together. And once they fuse together, they can be isolated and basically create a new strain. And this methodology was initially started with snake venom, which is a whole other story that I would love to make a film about because it's absolutely fascinating. But Doma didn't have access to the snake venom, so he tried it with this antibiotic.
Wait,
and,
is this...
Now he's evolved...
Is this different species fusing? So like Psilocybe azarescens
no,
with
different
cubensis?
Strains of... Yeah, no. It's different strains of the same species. So when he created Tidal Wave 2, the award-winning strain, he took a Penis Envy and a B plus and fused them together and had different isolations of those two strains and then brought them together to create more or less a new strain of cubensis. And, you know, my language describing this might be off because I don't know exactly the right words to say. I don't know when a phenotype emerges or not. And so one of the interesting things now is that, you know, he's switched his method now. Like the mycology, you know, sort of underground psilocybe growing community at that time was like, this is impossible. And he was new to growing at that time and was like, whatever, I'm going to try it anyway. And he succeeded. And that really changed the game for cultivation, especially in magic mushroom cultivation. But now what's interesting is like, we talk about Aziz being the most potent magic mushroom found. But the caveat to that is that it's one of the most potent mushrooms found in nature. Now these strains that cultivars are producing blow Aziz out of the water in terms of potency. And it's kind of shocking. And this is one of the most important things, the most important works that Doma and the Magic Michael fam are doing right now is testing protocols to help and protect dosing and make sure people are safe, that they know that they're getting a strain that has, you know, 1.5% versus 3.5%. And that's a significant difference in your psychedelic experience if you're eating a 1 gram at a low percentage and another gram at a high percentage. I mean, it can be shocking.
Huge. And even how you store it, right? I mean, you know, if people have
Oh, aftercare is enormous.
Year-old mushrooms that they didn't store correctly, and it's like, yeah, they're not as potent as the day after you pick them. You know, they're going to be very potent.
Yeah.
And this is the same talk in the functional mushroom space. It's like 1 gram of one company stuff is not the same as the other. You know, if you're talking about, is it coming from mycelium, or is it coming from the fruiting bodies? How is it extracted?
Right.
Etc.
Right.
You know, there's right. a lot of people, I don't know where it started, but people are like, I need 1 gram a day. And it's like, well, you know, yeah, 1,000 milligrams of one thing is wildly different from 1,000 milligrams of another.
Right.
And same thing with psilocybin. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and if you change one variable in the process, if you're changing the extraction process, if you're changing the strain of the mushroom, if you're changing the testing protocol, then you're going to get different results. Each of those variables changes the ultimate outcome, whether or not you're testing beta-glucans or polysaccharides or triterpenes or erinaceans or haricinones or any of the active alkaloids like psilocin, psilocybin, and beocystin and norbeocystin and origination. Those are all going to be affected initially by how you extract it, how it was grown, what substrate it was on. Every variable counts. And one of the big, you know, that's part of Doma's work as well. I mean, I really think you got to get Doma on the show to talk about this stuff because he's amazing and he's
definitely
doing really important work. He's trying to standardize all of these tests and extraction methods and trying to inspire other laboratories to share their results, because that's the only way we can get on the same page. And it's really fundamental to the health of the community that we have some kind of standard in this space. And I understand that too from the functional mushroom space as well, because we don't really have a standard for American testing. Like, I want to create a stamp that we can put on our products as brands, as producers, as extractors, as small-time growers, big-time growers, that says, yes, this is verified 1% erinacine. This is verified, you know, 30% beta-glucan or whatever the case may be. Like, we need that as we move forward and as functional mushrooms become mainstream. And they're on track to do that.
Another compound of interest in psilocybe as a essence is, and it's a weird one, I'd never heard of it before. And going down the rabbit hole, it kind of threw me for a little loop. But aruginacine, which you talked a little bit about at the very beginning of this episode, you said, oh, yeah, people were talking about, oh, you're going to find that weird mushroom that makes you paralyzed. And aruginacine, there's this whole thread apparently on Reddit where people call it the wood lover's paralysis or WLP phenomena, where some people, a small percentage of people, when they're eating wood-loving active magic mushrooms that like to grow on wood, there's a small percentage of people that have this physical phenomena where they can't move their body for up to 24 hours. And it's not a mental thing. Like, sometimes you're like couch locked or whatever. It's like a physical thing. And people think it's caused by this specific compound, aruginacine. And I'm just curious if you have any more insight on this.
I can't speak to that. I've never experienced it myself. I've only heard about it. When I asked Doma about it, he was saying that there is no documented evidence that this, but at least through his experience, whether or not, you know, aruginacin or beocystin are connected to this. He did mention that these compounds have to be coupled with the other alkaloids in order to be metabolized at all. Like, they don't cross the blood-brain barrier. And it's the entourage effect that allows them to cross the blood-brain barrier. He said they had to be paired with the other alkaloids or an MAOI, which I thought was really interesting. And the bottom line here is that we need more research. You know, these compounds are very little understood, and there's virtually no research on this stuff. and what actually those alkaloids are doing physiologically for us. And then, of course, how they work together, which is fascinating to me. And, you know, as this stuff becomes, you know, as magic mushrooms get decriminalized and legalized, you know, hopefully this will open the door to funding research so that we can understand this. In fact, there was a paper that was released a month and a half ago, co-authored by Giuliano Ferci and a number of other mycologists, well-known mycologists, where they basically like did a deep dive into the psilocybe genus. And the result was, oh, hey, like everything we thought we knew was wrong and we don't know anything about this.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, wow, what a massive takeaway. Like, I wonder how long they were researching it before they decided to make that their official conclusion.
Yeah, that was with...
Did you see that paper?
That was with Laura Guzman and a few other people. But
yes.
That was... she presented her findings, or at least some of them, at the last Telluride Mushroom Festival. And her talk was fantastic. Mm-hmm. It was incredible. And I'm kind of bummed. I interviewed her before Telluride, where she presented. I saw her years ago, interviewed her, and then she spoke and she talked about all these things that we didn't cover in the interview. And I was like, oh man, like this would have been great to talk about. But yeah, I mean, it was basically like there's tons of species in these fungariums that are labeled a specific magic mushroom species, and they, you know, based on further DNA analysis, they're actually not, or, you know, some degrade faster than others, and some, you know, they tested the active compounds and they didn't have any. And so it's just kind of like our understanding is not very good based on, you know, dipping into the past and pulling out these old species. And that goes the same with, like, you know, Latin names change all the time. And it's a big debate with like Ganoderma lucidum versus Lingzhir. Like, there's tons mm-hmm. of papers that say, mm-hmm. you know, they say the Latin name is Ganoderma lucidum, but we further mm-hmm. split, you know, Ganoderma. So it's like, okay, yeah. Well, were they actually talking about Ganoderma lucidum, or were they talking about Ganoderma lingzhir, or were they talking about or another Ganoderma? Yeah. And they're just calling it Ganoderma lucidum. And so now we're looking at these old papers and we're like, well, what species were they actually using? And so the same thing with a lot of these old psilocybe, it's like, well, okay, now we got to recreate the wheel again.
As well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, science continually evolves, and
it's so funny because this is just trying to figure out what to call it. You know, it's such a fundamental first step in working with these mushrooms. And, you know, it's like we have disagreements about what to even name them, let alone what's inside them and what's happening, you know, biochemically and our relationship physiologically to them. I mean, we are really at the beginning of a very long journey, and it's exciting. You know, I look forward to learning as new information comes out and telling these stories as they emerge. Like, I think it's really cool. I want to backpedal a little bit and go right back to this topic of the baeocystin, norbaeocystin, and originasin. Doma told me this morning that he's seen a peak on the HPLC chromatograph. Like, it's an unknown compound that's spiking at very high amounts, and we don't know what it is. And
cool.
When I asked him if there was any connection between the wood lover's paralysis and the minor alkaloid, he said, I don't know about that, but maybe it's this new mysterious compound.
Yeah.
This new mysterious alkaloid, which is spiking so high that it's not necessarily considered a minor alkaloid. So I think that's really interesting. And, you know, he's on track to discover this new compound, or at least
that's awesome.
Get closer to Yeah, and you know, I'm excited, man. I think it's such a cool. I think we're sort of collectively the point of the spear in this research, not only just in taxonomy, which is like the whole name game thing that we were just talking about, which is so funny to me because the Latin names are changing faster than the common name.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's like a can of worms inside the mycology community, you know, like, oh, how dare you use a common name? But, you know, if I'm out there hunting mushrooms in the Himalaya, you know, or in any sort of developing nation where the use of common the use of Latin names is not even on the radar, you know, that it's more effective and more helpful to have common names documented so that you can do comparisons to the Latin binomials later on if you're trying to do taxonomy. Like, they play a role in the whole scene. And it kind of makes me sad that there's a number of high level mycologists that outright poo-poo common names.
I get both sides, you know, whatever gets the point across. And yeah, you know,
yeah, of course there's a role. Like, we need standardization, right? We need a Latin binomial so everyone can be on the same page. But because of the onset of
don't white knuckle it.
Yeah.
Don't white knuckle it, because you know, that Latin name so that you're holding on to will probably change.
Right. Right. Let it go, man. Let it go. It's gonna be okay. Like, it's still
next
year is
gonna be a different one.
Mushroom, okay?
Yeah, it's all good. It's all good.
Have you read any of the work by Diana Smith and her research on the Ganoderma taxonomy debate? Highly recommend checking out Diana Smith's research papers around Ganoderma. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah. kind of backtracking a little bit, have you tried Psilocybe azarescens ever?
I did.
Feel free
to microdose them, though.
And did you notice any differences?
I ate a couple of fresh little ones.
Yeah.
I did. Yeah. They were, right off the bat, really tough, really chemical tasting, you know, that sort of strong chemical taste in the mouth compared to something like a cubensis that has a pretty mild flavor ultimately. And you know, it was beautiful, euphoric, mildly ecstatic, you know, very low impact. Like, I didn't have any discomfort feeling, no poison feeling. But I didn't really eat enough to trip, so to speak. It was much more of a micro. I probably ate a couple grams fresh.
Cool.
And
yeah,
I mean it wasn't like 100 milligrams dried, which is kind of a standard micro, you know. It was a small amount of fresh mushrooms,
right?
And I felt like it was my responsibility as an ethnomycologist, as a documentarian, to eat them. So it was for science.
Totally for science. I've never taken azarescens. I really want to, and cyanescens, and, you know, pretty much any of the woodlover species. But I did take this specific species called Psilocybe baocystin, I think is the name. And it was growing
Baocystis
in
or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. It was growing in Oaxaca, and someone was actually growing it. And it stayed at their house, and I ate way too much because it was fresh. And I had in my mind, oh, you know, and like, I need to take 10 times the amount that I usually do because it's fresh. And that was just a terrible idea. And I was like overly confident because I was like, fuck it. You know, like, I'm in this beautiful place. And like, you know, so I took even a little bit more, and I there's a point where I was like trying to make myself throw up because I was like, this is a little too much, you know? But oh, I got boy. Through it. It was an interesting night, to say the least. And it ended up, the ending of it was beautiful. But there was a period where it was pretty uncomfortable. But apparently that species had pretty high levels of baocystin in it, aka given the name. Yeah. I don't know how much it has, but it was an interesting... It was an interesting setting as well where I took it. So I do want to take it again with kind of a neutral setting and see my experience. Yeah. But yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would love to do, I would love to sample all the different strains, just to understand the differences. I've never tried Semilenciata, which is another common one that grows out in the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, you hear stories about all these different kinds all over the place. And I'm very curious about them, but, you know, it's so much ready and easy access to all the new Cubensis strains that it's almost like you have to go out of your way to go find these rare naturally occurring wood lovers or grass lovers. But, Yeah.
I feel like pretty soon we're gonna have dispensaries with a whole wide variety display, little sample box that you could take.
Totally.
You know, like a little chocolate box each thing is a different species that you have to correlate to the back of the chocolate box, and you got to match it. You're like, oh yeah. Caramel azarescence. Yeah, this one's the heart-shaped one. Let me get this one. Yeah.
Well, we're definitely, you know, the psychedelic mushroom industry is on track to parallel the cannabis industry. And that's one of the big sentiments in the psychedelic community is like, what can we learn from what happened with cannabis that we can avoid doing with psychedelic mushrooms? And I think that's one of the nice sort of guideposts in this emerging culture is like, look, it took 25 or 30 years to get cannabis recreationally legalized, and then magic mushrooms have kind of been fast tracked at like just a few years, you know. But it's, you know, dispensaries, you know, treatment centers, these things already exist and are going to evolve into this thing where ultimately it will be recreationally legal. It's just a matter of time. And, you know, we can all, you know, as mushroom people, be resources to the community, be advocates for safe use, for standardized testing, for potency testing, for extraction testing, you know, try and create some common ground so that the people who don't know anything about it and want to use it functionally can, or need it ultimately, can use these compounds safely and comfortably more than anything.
I really appreciate what you're doing with making these films because, you know, with this rise of psilocybin and functional mushrooms, tons of people are just hopping on the green rush, this new green rush. And it's worrisome for me. It's half exciting and worrisome. It's exciting to see so many people getting into mushrooms, but it's also worrisome because it's turning into such a commodity, which people are viewing mushrooms as a commodity and less of a connection vehicle to the greater symbiosis of nature and the universe, and really becoming a better person rather than using it as a commodity and kind of another costume in their ego of like, oh yeah, I microdose mushrooms, you know, and like using that as like another token. And so I just appreciate you making these films of kind of balancing that of like, yeah, you know, I sell functional mushrooms, but I also am making these films as a gateway for people to really dive deeper, you know? And it's like, yeah, take this for people who are brand new and, you know, take the product, but also learn more, you know, get out in the woods, like dive deeper, because there is something immensely magical and beautiful about fungi and their role in ecology and, you know, human nature, right? And how we interact with it. So
yeah, I mean, that's,
I just appreciate that. So keep pumping them out.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate that very much. You know, it's fascinating stuff, because what you're touching on here is how, for lack of a better term, functional fungi are across the board in our lives. You know, they can affect our food systems, our health systems, our agricultural systems, our applied mycology, like industrial systems, textile systems. You know, they can find a place in every major aspect of our lives and our society, and have profound impacts on them as solution makers. And, you know, we're just, as a culture, we're just beginning to explore the potential there. And it's a beautiful thing. You know, it's not just a mushroom that might make you feel good or help you sleep better, but it's also mycorrhizal or a primary decomposer, and has this essential fundamental relationship with nature, with ecology, or with a specific plant or a specific tree that makes everything else work in harmony. And that's such an awesome thing to try and wrap your head around and be a part of. And the films that I want to make explore all of these different ideas. You know, I mean, I've got long list of films I want to make. And I could really do with, you know, a team of 10 people to make it happen. Unfortunately, there's no budget for that.
Well, fingers crossed. I hope you win the lottery somehow and you make that happen. So you sent me kind of a secret link, and I know you just released this at the Fungi Film Festival, which is over now, which you won an award. Mm-hmm. So congrats on that. Yes. And well deserved.
Thank you. Actually, I just won another award for it as well.
Sweet. Hell yeah. Congrats. What's this other award?
Thank you. It won Best Documentary Short Film at the 8.5 Film Festival in Rome, Italy.
Wow. Dude, congrats. That's awesome.
And that's, thank you. Yeah, I just found out yesterday. And then it won Most Edutaining Film at the Fungi Film Festival.
Sweet. That's huge. That must feel good. That's awesome. So you sent me a secret link.
Yeah.
Is it going to be available for people eventually somewhere on the online?
Yes. Right now it's available on Vimeo on demand.
Okay.
I'll send you a link to that. You can rent it for $2 or buy it for $5. And your ticket purchase goes directly to financing the next film.
It's worth it.
You know, it's worth it. I mean, you got $2 to watch a half hour film. I mean, competing for attention on the internet is insanely difficult. But I think, you know, people out there, they choose to support the projects that they want to support. And, you know, I do the same thing with projects, you know, that I give money to. And there is an added value to paying $2 to watch a film like this. And that's that you are actively supporting the production of new mycology-centered film, which will ultimately become free in time. You know, I'll let it run its course through the festivals probably for another 6 months to a year, depending on how well it does in the festivals. And then it will inevitably end up for free on Vimeo and YouTube, and we can all enjoy it forever.
Hell yeah.
Until the solar flare comes and wipes all our hard drives clean.
And the your first film about Ophiocordyceps senescens, is that also on Vimeo as well?
It is, yes.
Cool.
It's also, you can find it on my Instagram and my YouTube, and It's out there. Please take the time to watch it. They're cool little short documentaries.
Amazing. Yeah. Cool. Sweet. And do you have a website? Where can people find you? We'll try to link everything in the bio for everyone to easy click, but for people just listening.
Yeah, you can check out my work and my products at hamiltonsmushrooms.com. My Instagram is Hamilton's Mushrooms. My YouTube is Hamilton's Mushrooms Extracts. My Facebook is Hamilton's Mushrooms Extracts. Please like, follow, share, do all the internet things. I appreciate everybody out there who takes the time to watch, the people who are the audience now who are listening. You know, my door is always open. My company ethos, my personal ethos, is that a rising tide lifts all the boats. And so if you're out there, you have a mushroom story you want to tell, you have a mushroom healing story or personal anecdotal experiences, you know, I want to hear about them. I want to help tell your story. I would love to collaborate with anybody out there who's interested and, you know, onward together.
Hell yeah. And thank you everyone for tuning in and shrooming in for another episode. It's always a really fun time. So thank you for wherever you're tuning in from all over the world. If you want to support the show, again, we don't have a Patreon or anything. So please head over to mushroomrevival.com. We have a bunch of goodies there from gummies and capsules, tinctures, etc. And we have a bunch of educational blogs and more. All of our show notes and podcasts are on there as well. And just spreading the word, you know, whether about our show or just mushrooms in general, about Hamilton's films, about anything related to mushrooms, you know, tell your friends, tell your family, collectively rise that tide for fungi as a whole.
Nice.
And, you know, it's all connected. The mycelium is spreading and it's all up to all of us to get people super geeked out about mushrooms and fungi and eventually just the universe and nature as a whole. So with that, much love and may the spores be with you.